Welcome to the podcast, keeping you in the loop for all things table tennis.
That is unbelievable.
And thank you for joining me on this episode of the podcast. In this episode, I'll be talking to Brian Pace. Now, for the newer players to the game, you will probably be familiar with him through Dynamic Table Tennis. That's his series of DVDs covering all aspects of table tennis from strokes, technique, footwork, training, tactics, serves. Covers it all, coming from the expert himself. And for those of you who have been playing for quite a while, you're certainly familiar with him as a former top U.S. player, which is not to say he's not a great player right now, but certainly he was more active in his previous years at a very high level. So we'll talk to him about how he first got started with the game, his progression, playing through college and afterwards, playing overseas, his encounters with other top U.S. Players, U.S. table tennis legends, also name drops his encounters with some other famous people outside of table tennis. So certainly a very interesting path he's traveled with the sport. And so a lot to get to. And he shares a lot of his insight on the game. So I think there's a lot to learn here as well. And just so you know, this was actually recorded a few days after the NBA Finals. And if you listen to the interview, you'll see what's particularly of note. Now, like I said, there's a lot to talk about. Very informative and very interesting. Brian, you can tell he's very passionate about the sport. And we clocked in about 2 hours. To me, the longer the better. So this clocked in at around 2 hours. Very generous of Brian to do this, take time out of his schedule. And like I said, 2 hours, so I figure I'll probably split this one into two parts. Looks like a decent length of a new segment coming up. And stay tuned to the end at the end of the episode. Like I've mentioned before, I'd like to get more participation, interaction with you, the listener. And at the same time, I'll let you know what's coming up in the next week, 2-3 weeks maybe, and how that all comes together. And like I said, there's a decent amount of news. Get to that, and then we'll talk to Brian. To start things off, there was the Shake Hand vs. Penholders charity event in China. That was on June 21st, and that was organized by Liu Guoliang. He is the current head coach of the Chinese team, also former world champion. And this charity benefited the local area of schools and firefighters and other local causes. So for the Shake Hand team, it included Zhang Jike, of course the current world champion, also Ma Long and Timo Boll. They faced off against the Penholder team, which included Ma Lin, Wang Hao, and Ru Sung Min. So, in the first match, Ma Lin beat Timo Boll convincingly. That was 3-0. Zhang Jike beat Wang Hao 3-0, so that even the score 1-1 between the two teams. In doubles, Ma Long and Zhang Jike team up to beat Ma Lin and Ru Sung Min. And probably Ma Long and Zhang Jike had the benefit of communicating with each other smoothly. And in the next match, Wang Hao beat Timo Boll, so that evened the series at 2-2. And honestly, Timo Boll did not look too good. I think this is where he had just flown in for this event, played the same day, so I guess that's a pretty good excuse. Also, playing Wang Hao and Ma Lin will do that too. So in the final game, the final set to decide it, they did not play an entire match. It was just one single game to decide the winner between these two teams. And this was Ma Long against Ru Sung Min. One single game. And in the middle, Mahlin called a timeout, gave Ruseman some coaching advice, so it's a little surreal. Pretty funny they were able to communicate with each other, and they mentioned, I guess, that through some kind of combination of Korean, Chinese, and English, they were able to get their message across. But ultimately, Ma Long came out the winner at 12-10. And so the shakehanders won. And afterwards, you can see Jeonju high-fiving Team of Wool. Also a little surreal. They're on the same team there. But entertaining charity event for a good cause. So that was fun to watch. And put in some just a little behind-the-scenes video up on YouTube. I'll put that in the show notes. You can see them hanging out beforehand. Kind of nice to see them. They all look very intense against each other, but now they're all relaxing and kind of see another side of them. So check that out in the show notes and on the website. Of course, the website is thepongcast.com. And for the next event that took place, that was the China vs. World Team Challenge. Another event to promote the sport that took place a few days later. That was June 25th, that was Saturday. And in this case, China was represented by Ma Lin, Ma Long, and Zhu Xin. The world team was represented by Timo Boll, Zhu Se-hyuk, and Jun Mitsutani. So in the first round, Ma Long took down Jun Mitsutani 3-0. Afterwards, Timo Boll beat Zhu Xin close match 3-2, evening the teams at 1-1. Ma Lin beat Zhu Se-hyuk 3-1. Afterwards, Ma Long beat Timo Boll 3-0. Basically giving them the match, giving the China team the victory. They played out the final match. That was Zhu Xin beating Zhu Se-hyuk 3-0. And actually, the day before was the women's event. China was represented by Guo Yang, Feng Yalan, and Zhu Yuling. The world team was represented by Kim Kyung-ah, from South Korea, Feng Tianwei from Singapore, and Ti Yana from Hong Kong. I hope I got those names right. Most likely not. I murdered them. I apologize. And the world team actually came out on top. They won that 3-2, so pretty impressive from the women's side, especially considering the, in general, the women's events, singles events, especially are dominated by the Chinese. So, overall, a nice event to help promote the sport. Also in conjunction with this event, Spin NYC, the spin club from New York City, of course, made famous, particularly one of its owners, is Susan Sarandon. So, the spin club from New York City, they came out to visit. They also had a exhibition event there. That was for, say, Chinese delegation. So, Spin was represented by Frank Rahoranozi. I totally got that wrong. He's one of the co-owners of Spin. Also, Su Yun Lee. She is a model and also a pretty good table tennis player. If you've seen her play, plays a mostly defensive chopper. She actually trained at the same school as Zhu Se-hyuk when she was younger. And she's currently rated at 2468. So, certainly not just a pretty face to represent the club. Also, fellow co-owner Jonathan Berkland, as well as, of course, Susan Sarandon, Academy Award winning actress. Also, Wally Green, another representative from the club. Also, he's rated 2321. He plays a lot of tour events, actually. And, also, Andrew Gordon, CEO of Spin. So they were there as another exhibition event playing against the Chinese delegation, which included Cao Yanhua and Zhang Deying, both former world champions. Li Xiaozhang, a Chinese model. Wang Wei, another retired player. And Wu Shai, a TV producer. And they had some kind of interesting format. I guess they were trading up every few points. And anyways, the Chinese delegation won. But like I said, it's a kind of nice event to promote the sport worldwide and bring people from all around the world. And this event took place in China, so everyone got to experience Chinese table tennis. And also, interestingly, Susan Sarandon was on a talk show with Meng Wuqin while she was there. And you can see them hang out with the world team earlier on. So, great event to promote the sport. Also in China, the Super League. The results, as of this recording, it was Ma Lin's team, Jie Jiang, beating Zhang Jiku's team, Shandong, and that was 3-0, very convincing. This was actually a very big event, this match, particularly because this was Teamable's first match playing in the Chinese Super League for this season. He was on Mullen's team, Jie Zhang, and he beat Fan Bo 3-2, very close game. And Team Wu wearing the team colors. This team colors in this case were actually red and yellow. The just like the Chinese flag, so almost looked like Team Wu wearing the Chinese uniform. And he represented his team well, getting the victory, and the crowd was totally behind him. Very entertaining to see. And can't wait to see more of his matches in the Super League. Lots to look forward to there. Also, Ma Lin faced Zhang Jiku in that matchup, and he won that very convincingly also, 3-0. So, overall, Ma Lin, who seems to be on a tear, of course winning the Chinese Open, and posting great results in the Super League, the exhibition matches, he looks great, what can I say? Maybe he's trying to make a strong push for the Olympics. Who knows? Looks like he's still got it. And more Chinese Super League results. Ma Long's team, Ning Bo, lost to Wang Hao's Bai Yi, 0-3. Ma Long losing his match to Yanan. Yanan, who's also posted good results in the Super League. Following that, Chen Qi's team, Zhang Su, if you recall. They were winless, and that would continue as they lost to Sichuan, led by Chu Yike, 1-3. Chen Qi won his first match, but lost to Sichuan's best player, Chu Yike, in the fourth match. And it's still the only team to go winless in both the men's and women's. And finally, Wang Lichen's team, Jin Zhou, lost to Zhu Xin's team, Bajo, 3-1. Wang Lichen lost both of his matches in this team matchup, losing his first match and losing to Zhu Xin in the fourth match, sealing the deal for Bajo. And I'd like to thank Table Tennis TA in particular, that's TableTennisTA.com, for the reporting on this event. Between reading the Super League page and that translated, and it's pretty difficult, so thanks for Table Tennis TA again for reporting on this event, and I'll put that link in the show notes. And in more local news, if you're in the U.S., the Broward Table Tennis Club Mugi Robo Open, the U.S. Open warm-up tournament that took place June 24th to the 26th in the Fort Lauderdale area, in Hollywood in particular. And Peter Paul Pradabine was the winner of the Open event. He is Canada's second best player. And, so good victory for him. And, interestingly enough, that same weekend was the Canadian Chinese Table Tennis Association in Ontario. They held the, International Table Tennis All-Star Challenge. So while Peter Paul was not there to attend, they did have, among the more notable players was Thomas Kynan. He actually had a disappointing finish there, placing 15th overall. And, he's supposed to be scheduled to attend the US Open, so I'm sure he's hoping for a better result there. Also, Alexander Karakasovich was there, finishing 8th. There was, Bastian Steger, the highest ranked player to attend at this event. losing to Wangji in the semifinal. Wangji is a defensive player hybrid kind of thing, like a Xu Xiehe. Also was Wallner's teammate at Fulda in the Bundesliga. And Wallner spoke highly of Wangji, saying I think he, if I recall correctly, I think Wallner said Wangji could be a top 50 player if he would just play offensively all the time. Nonetheless, Wangji's unique style got him the victory over Steger. In the other semifinal, the other two prominent players in this event were Bojan Tokic, and if you recall, he played a great match against Ma Long in the first round of the World Championships. He lost to Zoran Primorac, of course, a veteran of the sport, still going strong, ranked 37th in the world. So in the finals, that was Zoran Primorac versus Wangji, and Primorac took it. And so I guess that wraps up the news for now, and let's go to the interview. One thing I wanted to mention before we really get started. Okay. You may not realize this. You actually crashed in my apartment one time.
What?
Yeah, so this is kind of like, this is your life.
You're in what city are you in?
I'm in Ocala right now, but I live in Gainesville.
I think I remember that.
Okay.
2003, me and Raphael played a tournament, and was it Lee? Is his name Lee?
That's right. That's my roommate Lee, right?
Ha, okay.
You stayed at our place, and we wanted to welcome you, you know, do the college thing, throw a party for you guys. And then I realized you guys are like, it kind of hit me like, oh no, wait, you guys are actually pros. And and after looking back, I'm like, oh, I'm so embarrassed. Like we, you know, not that we didn't appreciate it or we didn't take it seriously, but at the same time, you know, we kind of split it up between having fun and doing the training thing.
But, yeah, it's no problem. And plus, like, I'm really conservative,
okay.
You know, so like, I don't do well with really loud parties.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I totally understand. Yeah. Looking back, we probably should have asked ahead of time, but, I really did appreciate you guys coming out. That was really useful and we all really enjoyed that.
Cool.
So that's that. So anyways, Brian, thanks for joining me on the podcast. I was looking forward to interviewing you, and I thought this might be a great time, and not particularly because of table tennis, but actually, because I was hoping there would be game seven, so you already know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Are you an NBA fan, and more specifically, maybe you're a big-time Mavericks fan now?
You know, when... At the beginning of the season, Rick Carlisle and I, the head coach, we became really good friends. He contacted me one day on my website asking about equipment. I think he had seen something I had done from Butterfly, and he called him and he said, "You know, where's Brian?" They said he's gone. So he found me, and we became friends ever since. And in the beginning of the season, I sent him a text. I said, "See you in the finals." You know, and he said, "Bet," you know, and I said, "If you make it to the finals, we go to dinner, you give me an interview, and we play some table tennis." And he said, "Perfect," you know.
Wow.
So when it actually happened, we were laughing because we were like, you know, like, I always follow the Heat, you know, because I've been in South Florida since 1997. So, you know, but then when I became friends with Rick, I've always followed the Mavericks, and these were the only two teams that I followed the whole seasons. And then to see them play, you know, going into game one, it was a little bit of a conflict because I really wanted seven games. I said, okay, I want the Mavericks to win, but I want seven games because I don't want, you know, with all this hype with the big three, it'd be nice if they go to the finals and go down 4-3. But I really was rooting for the Mavs, you know. So, created some conflict in the house.
I hear you. Yeah, I was wondering about that because I know you're based in South Florida and the Heat, all the Heat fans are there, but you became friends with Carlisle. And did you ever imagine meeting Rick Carlisle? I mean, you must come across a lot of people over your table tennis career, meeting people through table tennis, and that must have been quite a shock to get in touch with him. And I even saw in a video you actually stayed at his house at one time. And
yeah, I did.
He always visits you when he's in Miami, I guess.
Right. What happened was when he sent me the message, my best friend, which is a table tennis player, he's like 2,300. His name is Oscar Melvin. He lives in Dallas. And the last time I remember hearing Rick Carlisle's name was when they had that brawl with Artes in Indiana because he was the coach then. So
That's right.
I said, Rick Carlisle. Like, isn't he the coach in Indiana? So I picked up the phone. I called Oscar. I said, who's your head coach? He said, Rick Carlisle. And I just hung up. I said, okay, it's him. So we instantly hit it off because he's a major ping pong junkie, table tennis junkie. This guy calls me at 11 o'clock at night asking about how to play short pips. Or the next night, hey, I got my Noogie robot and I'm having a problem with this thing. He's a junkie. So, you know, our friendship really doesn't extend to it being celebrity status. It's just table tennis, you know, which is fantastic because everybody likes to, you know, whenever you meet somebody famous, you want to explore it. And every time that we hung out, he said, hey, man, get your camera out and shoot some video. And I was like, I'd rather just hang out. He's like, no, shoot it, man. I want to play some table tennis, you know, so. You know, it's been a real, you know, fun experience because, you know, I get insight into basketball. He gets insight into table tennis. He starts asking me about stories and I start asking him about stories. And I get to meet some really cool people. I had a chance to hang out with Dirk and all of those guys when I was at Dallas. So that was just fantastic.
I imagine that's incredible. Yeah, a great relationship, and he seems really down to earth, and it's so great to hear that he's really into the sport. I mean, I can tell just from the videos, he's really into it, and he's got game. You ever think he's going to start, has he started playing in tournaments? Is he interested in doing a USATT tournament anytime soon?
You know, I'm not going to discount it. His best friend, a guy named is Wayne, they were high school. No, they were college roommates in Virginia, and they played table tennis every day. And you'll see in one of the videos, Wayne played table tennis too. And he said, look, Brian, first he was a coach, and then he got into golf, and he became great at it. He got into bowling. He became great at it, and he got into table tennis, and he became great at it. So I know he's going to play a tournament because he has one of those personalities where once he gets hooked on something, he's just obsessed. You know, I mean, I haven't had a chance to meet a lot of coaches that are just so successful that anything they do, they're going to be great at it. Table tennis coaches have just played table tennis, you know, and Rick is just he's a constant achiever at everything, you know.
Right. That's that's incredible. You know, I might even throw yourself into that. I know you ventured off into a. What was that, mountain biking?
Biking and road biking.
Yeah, let me get into that a little later, and let me just wrap up this Rick Carlisle talk.
Sure.
One final thing is you emailed me a picture, and you were there with them, taking pictures with the trophy?
Yeah, you know, approaching game six, he basically asked me, I got a ticket, you know, like I could only get one ticket. Pat Riley would only give me one ticket. You know, sorry, your wife can't come. Do you want to come? And I said, sure. So I come to the game, and it's just pandemonium. And then after the game, right when the game ended, the meter in my car had ran out. And I said, man, I got to go. Like, I don't want to get this ticket. But, you know, and then one of the friends that was with us said, how much is the ticket? And it might have been like $30. But for me, it was about the ticket. It wasn't about the money. And the guy, like, said, forget the ticket. And just when I was going to try to slip out, Rick looked up at us and said, hang out. Like, stay, hang out. And not even 5 minutes later, he basically took us all back in the locker room. Everything you see on ESPN with the champagne flowing everywhere, we were standing right there.
Oh, man.
You know, it was just an unbelievable experience to see the look on these guys' face. I mean, they're pouring champagne on each other. They're hugging. And then we basically went into the office, and Rick said, look, you guys are my inner circle, so I want to thank you guys for keeping me sane, because this was a really stressful time. So it was, yeah, I almost felt like it wasn't my experience to have. But he was like, Pace, like every time I come to town, we have dinner, we play table tennis, that calms my nerves, you know? So, you know, I was just flattered to be a part of that, you know?
Well, that's, you know, I'm a big NBA fan, so you're living the dream, and that's awesome that you got to actually be there in the locker room. Yeah, I can't believe it. That's so cool to hear.
Yeah.
And taking pictures with them and all that. So that's just incredible. All right, yeah, so.
I still don't believe it now. Like,
yeah.
I put the pictures up on my Facebook, and everybody, I mean.
They must be asking, is that Photoshop?
Yeah, the first time, like, one of my best friends, like, a guy named Todd Swear, said, is this real? Like, how do you know this guy? Like, I mean, were you really there? And it was just unbelievable to be there I'm sitting right there when they're giving the interviews. I'm
great.
Sitting right beside Dirk when he's saying, I stink of champagne, you know? So it's pretty special.
That's crazy. Well, I mean, it shows Rick Carlisle is a good friend, and you're a good friend to him, too. And,
yeah, man. I mean,
that's great to hear. And table tennis brought you guys together. So, and great to hear that he's so hooked into the sport, and we need, you know, more people. Obviously, we always want more and more people joining the sport. And somebody like Rick Carlisle can get into it. That's really great to hear.
Yeah.
So, awesome. So when you're a kid and you picked up the sport, you probably never imagined you'd get an experience like this. But let's go to that beginning. How did you get into the sport? What drew you to it?
Well, wow, this is a unique story. Butterfly, North America is based in my hometown. Which is really, I'm from Wilson, North Carolina, which is population 43,000 people. Mm. And the family that basically carried Butterfly in America got a connection with USATT. So they went to USATT and said, give us a grant. We want to coach kids. So what had happened is the coach came to the school and he did exhibitions in every single school in the city, every single elementary school, every single high school, just did exhibitions. Within a week, he had like 75 kids playing. And that's how I got started. And what the coach said is, I'm rich, but they gave money to us to pay ourselves to coach you. What we're going to do is allow you opportunity to work at Butterfly, make rackets, assemble tables, and create your own account so you can play tournaments. So that's what I did. I would get out of school. I would go there. I would assemble rackets. I would assemble tables. I would do anything they needed me to do. I would fill orders. And then when the company closed, we'd go in the back of the building and we'd play table tennis.
Wow.
So that's really how I got started, which was just, you know, it's perfect. I was inside of a table tennis company. So at the same time I was learning how to play, I was understanding what it is to be inside the table tennis industry. So, I mean, within a year, I started in 1986. In 1987, we were the best junior team in the country.
How old were you when that all started?
I started in February of 86, and I was 13. And I turned 14 in April. So 2 months later, I was 14. So I practically started when I was 14.
Okay. And so you're working the Butterfly, you're getting that coaching, and you said you had the top junior team?
Yeah, we started, and within 1 year, 0 to 1 year, we were the best junior team in the nation.
Wow.
Like, nobody knew. We went to New York, and we won basically every single title.
Really?
And then the next year, we had just as much success in the singles, and then we won a team event. It was like, who are these kids from North Carolina? Because we had basically just traveled North Carolina, South Carolina, Maryland, Virginia. And I think I might have been ranked top five in the country before I even left my area.
Wow.
You know, so we didn't know how fast we were progressing because, you know, we didn't have any, we couldn't compare ourselves to who the top junior was in Michigan, who was the top junior in California. We just, we were just looking at names, you know, our names and numbers beside those names. So it was really just, you know, unique how fast we improved. And it probably was good because we didn't need a barometer. We were using ourselves as the barometer. This guy's getting better. I want to get better too, you know.
Yeah. So you had perfect, who would have known you're in your, what you would consider a small town. You're actually in the perfect place at the perfect time. And so you had all that training and competition and coaches. Now you mentioned you had a lot of good players with you. I mean, are any of them like notable names that we might still recognize?
You know, the only notable name that people will remember is Oscar Melvin. He got to maybe 2350, and he's a really good player, and he was the last person, you know, to quit, you know, or retire. Probably within 3 years, the training just got too hard. I mean, they brought in these coaches that were Nigerian. They were 2600, and they weren't coaching us. They were training. They were training with us. And then when I say training, we would go out and we run 5 miles. Well, Jason, if you're 14 years old or you're 15, you can't keep up with a 28-year-old African for 5 miles.
Yeah.
You know, so what happened is people started to quit because they could not handle the workload, the physical workload. I mean, parents were coming over and they were saying, look, my son comes home at 7 o'clock and he goes to sleep in the same clothes he was training in and does not wake up until the next morning. What in the world are you guys doing over here? And the coach, you know, the owner of Butterfly, his son was the person that was in charge of the program. And, you know, he probably didn't have as much experience. And he basically said, if you're not trying to make the Olympic team, you shouldn't be here. You know, which in hindsight, I look at it, it probably wasn't the best attitude because if we want to grow our sport, we need to focus on, you know, we need to focus on everybody participating. You don't have to do the Olympic pipeline.
Right.
You can do just local pipeline or regional pipeline. But he basically said Olympic or die. Nobody can handle it. I mean, in fact, this one of the stories, one of the years, I finished second place in under 16 boys at the Junior Olympics 1 year. And the person that beat me was my best friend. And when he shook my hand, he whispered in my ear, I'm quitting. That's how fed up he was. He won the national championships. And when he was shaking my hand, I'm distraught that I lost. He said, I'm quitting.
Wow.
And he's never played another tournament again. But he has played table tennis every single week. I have him on my YouTube page. I tell the story to everybody. I say this guy could not handle the training, but still wanted to participate. Yeah. You know, so you know that was probably the thing. The thing that was great about the program was the very thing that imploded the program. It's because, you know, nobody. I mean, you had to be built like me. I'm 14 years old, and I look like a fullback. So yeah. I handled the training, but not everybody else could handle the training. So, but in this program, Todd Swears came to North Carolina, Eric Owens, Randy Cohen. You can now almost every top junior in the country came to North Carolina. That's how popular the program was.
Oh, okay.
I mean, even Larry Hodges, he used to be the editor of the magazine.
Yeah.
He came there for 1 summer just to say, what is all the hoopla about these kids in North Carolina? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And then two years after the program started, me and Oscar were invited to move to Colorado Springs to be in the Olympic, to be a part of the Olympic Training Center resident program, which means you live there all year and trained.
Right.
And that's when the program started to kind of split hairs because the two top players and the leaders of the program moved to Colorado, you know?
Right. Okay. So yeah, it sounds like people burned out.
Yeah.
It was really, very intense. I mean, that's more intense than any your high school football, basketball team, whatever. That's not even close.
Yeah.
That's intense. And like you said, a lot of people dropped out. I mean, that's great. They had 75. You said maybe up to 75 kids playing. So what made you stick with it? Because it sounds like you're really the only one that really continued seriously afterwards.
You know, initially it was really immature or selfish reasons. I remember because at this time I had done track and field, I had done Taekwondo. I was state champion in Taekwondo, like under 13. So if they go check it, it was AAU. So, the fact checkers can. I was a national champion, state champion in Taekwondo. And that first summer I played, all my friends went to football camp about, 120 miles away from Wilson, you know? And I went down to Miami and I saw boobs on the beach. And I said, wait a minute now, like my friends are in football camp and I'm looking at these women on this nude beach in South Beach. And I'm saying, I had a better summer than you guys, And then like the next day I was in the hotel and I looked down and they were shooting Miami Vice right in the lobby of our hotel. And I just said, this sport, it's exotic. Yeah. Then, like 4 months later, I was in Las Vegas and I was in a elevator with Ice-T and Jerry Lewis. And I said, this my sport. Wow. And really what I liked about it is that it wasn't just every other thing I had ever done was just a bunch of black kids. Mm-hmm. And now I'm at a tournament and I'm playing this Chinese guy and he's 5'5". I'm playing this European guy. He's 6'4". I'm playing this person from New Delhi, India. I'm talking to this white doctor from South Africa. And I said, I think this is my sport. So I like that it was really obscure. It was so many different people that was the main thing that fascinated me about it,
Wow. So that's really, it's really interesting. I guess you're quite a sociable person. And I can tell you're really outgoing and, you really kind of sell yourself well with the sport and everything. And so I guess that all makes sense. And so now that you went to Colorado, and how old were you when that happened?
I was 16.
16. Yep. And so now you're moving away from home, right?
Yes, that was probably one of the most difficult things in my life, because what happened was over that summer, one brother went to the military, one brother went to college, and then I moved out to go to Colorado. So I had an older sister. She was already at the house. So my mom went from, in the beginning of summer, she had a full house. At the end of the summer, she had nobody in the house, So my dad died when I was 10. So my mom is like, the house is empty. She was traumatized. So after my first semester, I think I had like one C. She made me move back to North Carolina. Years later, I find out she did it just because she missed me. But for me, I'm shocked. I'm like, Mom, I got a C and I got to relocate back to North Carolina. She was like, yes. And I was like, oh, my God.
Wow.
And then my junior year, she did it again.
Okay.
I said, then my senior year, I said, okay, I'm not going back. I'm not going to go back. I'm staying the whole year, So those years at the Olympic Training Center, those were the years that I really learned how to be an athlete.
Uh-huh.
They didn't care that you played ping pong. Nobody there looked down on the sport. We go to these, every week you had to do, you had to go to sports psychology.
And the
first thing they dealt with us is how do you see yourself? And the first thing I said is, how does society see us? They don't give us the credit that they give other sports. And just throughout that time, I learned how to respect the professionalism of my sport and to not, treat myself as a second class citizen, compared to the other sports. So being there really taught me how to be an athlete emotionally. I mean, time management, self-management, emotional management, all of those things, I had counseling when I was 16 years old. Every week they'd ask me these, 30 or 40 questions, and I had to give open-ended answers. I couldn't give a yes or no answer. So that still affects me to this day, like in a good way, to where I don't mind having a deep philosophical conversation because I'm really comfortable with myself. And it's because of how comfortable I am with saying I'm a table tennis athlete,
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I guess we're all, as players, we're all kind of fighting that image and, when somebody asks you or what you like to do or what you're good at, you say table tennis, and you can't help but like kind of look away or
I've learned to just look them right in the face and then say, because at some point I have to say, hey, I play table tennis. Yeah, they call it ping pong. of course I'm a black guy. It's not a lot of us, but I'm really good.
Yeah.
Next question.
So that's interesting. Also bring up the psychology part, because I guess especially in recent years, that's, you know, sports is always evolving from equipment to technique, and certainly psychology seems to be now people are really incorporating that into sports and realizing that can be really important to help people out. So what were maybe some helpful things that you kind of learned? And also, I mean, just being Colorado Springs, that it made you grow up really quick. I mean, you're 16 on your own, and you're dropped into a professional environment, really for what's grooming pro athletes. So
yeah, I mean, the first thing it taught you real responsibility. You know, once we got there, you know, you had to wake yourself up. Mm-hmm. You know, we lived in a dormitory. I mean, there was three dormitories, and the first one was for resident athletes. We were down the hall from Christy Yamaguchi.
Wow.
You know, all of those people, they lived in the resident, you know, dorm. And the first thing you learn is, you know, a real sense of, you know, responsibility. You're going to have to do your own laundry. You're going to have to distinguish between whites and colors, because if not, you have some pink socks.
Yeah.
I mean, just little things like that you learn at 18 in your college, you learn at 16 when you're saying, my mom is across the country, you know, so... that was probably the first thing that, you know, when I came back home, that was a noticeable difference from my mom, is that I didn't need her to do anything that I could do myself,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, probably, you know, going there and mingling with other athletes and, you know, really understanding, you know, what you're there for. You're mm-hmm. there because they want you to make the Olympic team,
right?
You know, so that was just fantastic. I think I answered the second part of the question, but I forgot the first again.
The psychology part about it, certain things that made you think about that you maybe never considered, or you know, maybe developing confidence or things like that.
Yeah, you know what happened was, I don't know if you know Scott Price.
He's
a table tennis player. He does a lot of exhibitions. That's kind of his thing. One day, everybody left practice and I was there serving. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm serving, you know. And he said, it's Thursday night and tomorrow we're flying to Georgia to play a tournament. It's not going to make a difference now. But go back to your dorm, turn the lights off, close your eyes, think about three things that you're going to do. And then when you go to Georgia, make sure you do those three things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those were the things that helped me the most, because once I got there, I realized I was really gifted physically, but I had only been playing 2 years.
Yeah.
And Todd Swears and Chisan Chui and Jimmy Butler and Sean O'Neill, Darren Narratan, these guys have been playing 8 or 10 years.
Yeah.
And they just said, Brian is a physical specimen and he has perfected the form. But what he has not perfected is how to compete. Uh-huh. And it took me a long time to learn how to do that. And, you know, Shane Murphy was my sports psychologist. And he would take me through these exercises where he would say, okay, Brian, you're going to get on the van and go to the Colorado Springs airport. You're going to fly to Denver. And when you get to Denver, you're going to eat a bag of chips. And then when you get back on the plane, you're going to listen to your Walkman. And when you get to Georgia, you're going to, I mean, he basically took me through the entire competition. When you get to the competition, say hey to your friends, check the draw, see who you play, go look at the tables, look at the floor, look at the lighting. You know, where's going to be your place that you can sit down for 20 minutes and actually gather yourself? By the time I got the tournaments, I knew exactly what I needed to do, and it wasn't like pulling teeth. It was a natural progression. So you learn how to walk the walk, you know. So when you see these 13-year-old, you know, gymnasts, and they're on this world stage, and you look at their eyes and their focus, it came from years and years of being walked through the process. And that's probably the number one thing that I've taken away from being there, because, you know, like my wife always says, like, Brian can achieve anything all the time. He can go ride his bike 200 miles and he can come in the house and he can edit video all night. And the next day he can just keep doing it because he's acclimated to how much he wants to push himself physically. And that controls what he thinks about emotionally. Because, you know, my wife is a therapist. And she just says, I don't understand what planet you're from. You know, and it's come from learning that early. Mm-hmm. You know, she's always been amazed at how willing I am to talk. Well, it's because at 16, you know, my sports therapist said, what's going on in your mind? And I'm like, oh, man, the first thing I said is, I'm not crazy. And he was like, OK, we got that out of the way. Like I said, what's on your mind? You know, so you learn how to be honest with yourself. Mm-hmm. And if you're honest with yourself, you know, not being cocky or egotistical, everybody else will see what you're about if you're honest with yourself, you know?
Okay. Yeah, that's, you know, talking about psychology stuff, I mean, you know, those things you mentioned, I mean, when you boil it down, it sounds so simple, but really, it never occurs to anybody to do any of those things. And like you said, having him, you just walk through in your mind, going through all these steps, going to the tournament. I can, you know, just talking about it, I can see how that would help a lot, just putting your mind at ease, already knowing what to expect, and giving you that, I guess, that comfort level that, you know, right. not having that unexpected anxious feeling. So right. That's really, you know, stuff like that, very useful to hear. So at the Colorado Center, what might be a typical day? Just curious, you know, as far as just the strict training, drills, warm-ups.
You know, we'd get up in the morning, and at least 3 days a week, we would train early in the morning. And it's just basically you get there at, you know, 6:30 and you train until 7:45. But this is just like an all out training session because you only have an hour before you can get ready and get to school. So mm-hmm. we basically would train Monday, Wednesday, and Friday once in the morning, go to the cafeteria and basically take the bus 2 miles down the street to where our high school was. Mm-hmm. And one of those days, Sean O'Neill came in. Sean O'Neill is a 5-time U.S. champion, 2-time Olympian. He basically said, you know, I think he had just got back from the Olympic Games in Korea. And he said, you guys aren't working hard. I'm really not impressed. I just came back from the Olympics. I know what hard work is.
I read your story about this. Yeah, please tell this. Yeah, this
okay.
is a good story.
So he basically says, hey, you know, you guys aren't really working hard. You know, you guys aren't doing jack. That's what he said. And then at the end of that conversation, he kind of whispers in my ear, Brian, you want to run with me tomorrow? And I'm kind of feeling egotistical. I've probably been there 3 weeks and everybody said, this guy's an athlete. And Sean said, I'm going to take him running. And I said, oh, man, of course. And I said, what time? He said, I'll see you at 6:00. We get out at 6:00 and we're jogging across the Olympic Training Center complex no faster than my grandmother. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, man, when we get off the complex, I'm going to smoke this guy. And we made a right turn on Boulder Street and he took off. And when I say took off, this had to be Ethiopian. This wasn't African-American. No, it wasn't. This was Ethiopian speed. You know, this was Mount Kilimanjaro tempo that this guy's running. And I'm thinking he's just running to just flush out the lactic acid in the legs. But then like 2 miles later, I'm like, I'm dying. And remember, this is 6,000 feet altitude. I can't breathe.
Yeah.
You know, so we basically run 4 miles and we run up this landfill. I'm talking diapers and like manure and uh-huh. sticker fries and broken yeah. bottles. We run up the side of the dump. We run back down. And then maybe around mile 7, he just put me out of my misery. And I got back. Ate breakfast, went to my dorm room, threw up, and didn't come out of my room for 3 days. Had a fever. Man. I never run so hard that I had a fever. They said, you have to drink liquids and soup. I said, I was running. And he said, okay, you don't know how to train if I can take you on a 10-mile run and you are sick for 3 days. Mm-hmm. And then he basically said, now you know what real work ethic is like. And wow. that's when I realized everybody already had to run. Uh-huh. Darren got to run. Jimmy got to run. Todd Swift got to run. Everybody got to run. And I was just being initiated. And from that point forward, I knew how to turn myself inside out physically. I knew how to take myself to the brink. And maybe 4 years later, I beat him in the tournament.
Wow.
And he said, I knew you. The only way you could have won that match is you had to have done as much work that I showed you. For you to stand in front of me and have that much confidence. And I said, look, now I knew what it looked like. training hard should look and feel like this. And that was a really great lesson that I learned from Sean. That's one of the things that I took from this, how to turn yourself inside out.
That's a great story, man. I love hearing that. And yeah, I mean, if anyone can hear that story, questioning table tennis as a sport, I mean, that's, you know, that says it all. And,
listen, I mean, I get at least once a year, Sean O'Neill will send me a GPS photo of that dump. He'll send it to me as a JPEG. A happy birthday. Last time he sent it to me was April 28th, my birthday. He sent me a GPS Google map picture of the dump. And you know what I did?
Oh, that's cool.
I started sweating. He just hurt my feeling. He just reminded me of the pain, you know? So right. At the same time, you work hard, but, you know, still humbled.
That's awesome. And, you know, not to denigrate U.S. table tennis right now, but that sounds like the heyday. I mean, you're in the thick of it, and really impressive that you started 13 and to be at that level. I mean, that's really remarkable. I mean, you know, people always want juniors, you know, people think you got to be at it. You got to start when you're 8 or something like that. And so it's amazing you reach that level starting when you're 13 and you're hanging out with what I would consider probably one of the peak moments of U.S. table tennis in recent history with Sean O'Neill and Jimmy Butler, guys like that.
I mean, I agree. I mean, when I look at it now, table tennis seems so corporate.
Uh-huh.
I mean, back in that time, everybody would just train together. Yeah. You know, I mean, it was a collective attitude about we need to be better.
Yeah.
And it seems like now with people wanting to protect their rating, it's like, no, I just have to have a number that's higher than yours. And it doesn't really involve us working together to achieve that, you know. So, you know, I'm really, you know, I'm old school. And yeah. I look at how it is now and I say, man, I don't know if I could have coexisted during this time, because what I realized I needed to do was just work really hard. I said, okay, I'm going to work really hard at this craft. And when you look at the craft, it's not just footwork or hand speed. It's what do I do so that I learn how to not lose the match when the score is 18-all? Because
mm-hmm.
everybody on the team says Brian is so wired at 18-all that he'll make two simple mistakes mm-hmm. after he's made a great loop. He'll make a great loop and the score will be 19-18 and he'll lose the rest of the game because he's so emotionally wired.
Mm-hmm.
Every person on the team said this guy's out of control emotionally. So if you look at me compete now, years later, I never say a word.
Uh-huh.
You'll never see emotion on my face. You'll just see a poker face. I learned that from being in that collective group, you know, and I just don't think, you know, I lived in Maryland. I spent some time out at that in the Bay Area before it became what it is now. And that wasn't the attitude.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't how it was. So, I mean, you know, I don't know where it's going to go, but it's a lot different than how it was when I came up, you know?
Yeah, I mean, correct me wrong, if I'm wrong, but it feels like back then there's more of a team camaraderie. Everyone's hanging out with each other more. I mean, I guess also you have to think that back then you had the Olympic Training Center. I mean, nowadays they don't really have that now, do they? Or at least for table tennis.
They don't. Gone. I mean, Sean O'Neill, I mean, gave me every piece of information that he knew.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Butler gave me every piece of information. Jimmy Butler told me something one time. He said, nobody's going to ever ask how many practice matches you've won.
Right.
Because one day I was in there playing a practice match and I was trying to win the match. He said, what have you been working on for the last 2 hours? Because that's what you should be practicing.
Yeah.
You're not going to get that information unless you can be around those kind of people.
Uh-huh.
Because I don't think, you know, if you're a top player and you're seeing some young up-and-coming player just doing it wrong,
mm-hmm.
you're going to give them that advice.
Yeah.
You're going to be compelled to just give them that advice, you know? So, I mean, I really, during my time, I got so many gems. Like Coach Li Shanxi, he is the coach that he's involved with the ICC. He told me something. He said... you got to triple bounce your serve in training, because with the nerves you're going to feel in competition, you're going to double bounce that serve.
Oh, okay.
See, I just got these golden nuggets. My mom called them nuggets. That's a nugget.
Yeah.
When you're in training, triple bounce that serve. Mm-hmm. Don't double bounce it and think that's enough. Triple bounce that serve. Because you want to double bounce that serve when the score is 9-all. Perfect. I would never go into a training session and ever double bounce my serve.
I mean, when you say it now, it makes common sense. Like, why didn't I think of that? But, I mean, that is real. That, like you said, a gem of, like, a nugget of a gem there. That's so valuable to incorporate. So, and getting that advice from all those guys, they're world class. Jimmy Butler was in the top 100 in the world. And, you know, all those guys are competing, they're world class level. So, that's great to hear. And, that you're experiencing that, got to hang with them and you're at that level too. So, so after Colorado Springs, you did that for how long?
I was there from 1988 to 1991.
91. And then what did you...
In 91, when I finished high school, well, the Olympic Training Center, I think based on my level, I think I might have been like 2270. And I got there, I might have been like 1900. Uh-huh. And I was 2270, and they said to be here as an adult, you have to be over 2400. So, well, I couldn't stay. So I went to Augusta, Georgia, where there was a program with Derek May. Dad started a program in Augusta, Georgia, at Augusta College, and that's where Jimmy Butler's brother, Scott, was. Okay. So they already had two 2,400 players there, and a couple other players, maybe 2,100, 2,200. So I said, okay, that's the place to go. I can go to school, and I can still play table tennis. Mm-hmm. So that's where me and Oscar went. We both went to Augusta, Georgia, and within a year, we won the collegiate championship.
And, that's tough competition. Dyron Noritem, he was still in. Was he also competing at the college level at that time?
You know, Dyron retired probably in 92 or 93, and he just, he just never played again. I think he had a lot of success early, and right when he got to maybe 18 or 19, he just said, I don't need any more. You know, so I think he just went to college, and I don't think he played much table tennis in college.
So you're in college. You did that, had a lot of success there, and you felt that the training there was maintaining you or improving
the training level. There was good. That the training there advanced me. I mean, the issue was: are you going to be committed to going to college, or are you going to be committed to playing table tennis? And I actually lost my Butterfly sponsorship after about 6 months of being there because, you know, the owner was invested in me going to college because he said, I eventually want you to come back and basically run the company. He said, okay, I'm going to cut you because I don't think you're going to go to college. Well, what happened before that is I think my mom made too much money for me to get financial aid. So I was going to wait 1 year and then file for myself so I can get financial aid because I was like working at Burger King and then I was just training.
Yeah.
So he cut me and then maybe 4 or 5 months later, I was in school and then I got over 2,400. And then he kind of heard the whole story and said, okay, well, we can still sponsor you again. So the training there, I mean, that was just a whole nother level that just went up because now the players were better. Mm-hmm. The training was more intense and everybody was adults. You know, I didn't have to train sometimes with a 14-year-old. Right. Everybody I trained with was in their 20s. They just kind of had the maturity to finish a 2.5-hour training session without sometimes pouting like a kid because they're tired. So that had its own benefits also.
Okay. That's a lot to balance. At that time, I imagine that's,
Man, I worked like stressful. Three jobs. I worked at the Augusta Chronicle. I worked at Zaxby's, and then I coached table tennis on the side at the same time that I was in school.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when I look at it now, I say I don't even know how I did it all. But I was frying chicken Friday night, and then Saturday morning I was coaching table tennis. Monday afternoon, I was working at, the newspaper. So, I mean.
Well, you're definitely dedicated. Obviously, since every step of the way, you've been really dedicated. A lot to deal with. And so you're in Augusta. You're doing that. What's the next step after that?
You know, Richard McAfee came to me and he said, Brian, you're a coach. And this might have been when I was 16. And he said, you're a coach. You're going to be more successful as a coach than a player. and he walked away. Really? And I went, what in the world? And he said, there's going to be a time I come looking for you, and it's going to be for a coaching job. And he said that to me in probably 1998. Well, 1995, he calls me up and he said, there's a rich kid in New Orleans and they need a coach. They need a full-time coach. Are you willing to move there? And this is right around the time where Augusta was starting to kind of lose his pizzazz, uh-huh. You know?
Yeah.
And I said, I think this is the time to leave. So I moved to New Orleans and I did a one-year coaching job for this kid, John Beaumont. And I think he might have been 1,600 when I got there.
Okay.
And in 1 year, he was like 2,160, and he had won a national title.
Wow.
And that's when I realized I was a coach. I realized I could coach.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't sure if I was a coach. I said, well, I think I know what I'm doing because this kid was 1,600, and now he's a national champion. He's under 16 boys national champion, and his rating has gone up 500 points.
Uh-huh.
You know? So that was kind of the next thing that I did. That's when I said, okay, there's real money in coaching. Because when you show up at a tournament, Jason, you got to really look at who's going to be in Las Vegas and how much money does it cost for you to get there and how much money can you win? Mm-hmm. Well, when you coach, you don't have to worry about that. You just make the money.
Yeah.
So that was where my real focus started to be. It's like, okay, if I really want to do well at table tennis, I have to kind of have this crackhead mentality. And I know that sounds funny, mm-hmm. but a crackhead will steal a TV to go get crack.
Yeah.
And what I was doing was coaching table tennis to pay for my table tennis training. Well, that's the crackhead mentality.
Yeah.
If I can coach and I can get this money and I can do this coaching clinic and I can do this coaching clinic, I can make enough money to go to Japan. And right. that's what the coaching started to be. It was a means to an end. I need to train. And the coaching is the financial way to get it done, you know? So that's when the whole coaching door opened for me.
And that's a tough part in the U.S., you know, especially for players to reach a high level and to be financially independent. That's a really tough thing. And like you said, you had to do coaching. And so how hard was it to balance coaching and maintaining your own level?
In New Orleans, it was impossible. Because there was nobody in within a 250-mile radius that was over 1,900. Mm-hmm. So I basically stayed 2,400 for 1 year practicing on like a Noogie robot.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I was fed up. I said, okay, I'm never coaching again. Never. And I moved to Maryland. And I think I was like 2,395. I moved to Maryland. And 2 months later, I was 2,600.
Wow.
Yep, I was training with Gal June, uh-huh. Sean O'Neill, Todd Swears, Sean Lonergan, Chen Yin Hua, Shuhua Zhang. That was six players that were all above 2450. And I was getting, I trained at least 6 days a week. And within 2 months, you can look June 1996 to August 1996. I go from 2400 to 2600.
That's crazy. And I'm sorry, what year was this again?
1996.
That's crazy. Yep. And I mean, in perspective, I might say 2,400 back then is probably harder to attain back then than today.
Yeah.
I don't know if you agree with me on that one.
The players at 2,400 now, I'm like, dude, you're not 2,400, you're 2,250.
Yeah. I mean, back then, the level 2,400 was already hardcore.
Yeah. 2,400 was a lot harder then.
Yeah.
And what happened after that is, okay, well, I got to still work. So I started working at a Blockbuster and started working at a bicycle shop.
Uh-huh.
Because in Maryland, the coaching was full. Chen had the coaching. Jack had the coaching. It was all full. And I said, man, I can't even coach 3 hours in this place a week.
Right.
And, you know, so I moved there thinking I would get the coaching and got there and realized it was locked.
That's probably the toughest city to coach in at the time.
I didn't realize it at the time because in New Orleans, I could not. I had to throw people away. I said, I can't coach you. I cannot. I'm not going to coach 50 hours a week. Uh-huh. It's too much, you know. So after 1 year of there, I got an offer to move to South Florida. It was basically these rich families, you know, uh-huh. said, you know, you can stay with us in this house, guest room,
mm-hmm.
and just coach our kids. Right. And then they said, we'll pay for your school. And I said, whoo, I got a deal here.
Nice.
You know, so that's what I basically did. I moved to Broward County, and that's when my game started to flourish, believe it or not.
Really?
I'd had all the good training, and years later, my practice partner was 1800. If you look on all my videos, his name is Rafael.
Sure.
Curly Spanish guy from Chile. He's 1800. And he was my practice partner. And everything, and this was a new challenge for me because it was the first time that I really trained hard and I didn't have proper training partners.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at from during that time, my rating just kept going up. It just kept going up because now I knew how to utilize all the training that I needed. And just to back up a little bit, from 1990 to 1997, I didn't win a tournament.
Really?
I didn't win one tournament. So in 1994 was when Oscar quit because he said it's too hard. This is my limit. I'm not going to get any better.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Brian, you're going to make it just because we can look in your eyes and know that you've never doubted yourself. And I honestly never doubted myself. And what I realized I had to do is I just had to keep working hard. And I think I might have had some conversation with my mom, and she's told me something she reminded me of something a long time ago. She said, you're going to have to do what I told you to do as a kid. And you're either going to, there's two things that you have to do. And that's, you have to exercise and you have to read. You know, if you exercise, there'll be days out that you're running and you kind of feel like stopping, you know, that's your mind messing with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can learn how to control that voice, there'll be no limit to what you can do. And if you read, you'll learn all the other stuff. Right now, if we start talking about porn, somebody wrote a book about porn.
Uh-huh.
If we start talking about apples, somebody wrote a book about apples. So at this day and age, how can you ever have a new idea? You can't have a new idea.
Yeah.
The times that you say you picked your dog up from the vet, whatever was wrong with your dog, somebody wrote a book about that.
Yeah.
So my mom said, you will never have a new problem. Whatever problem you have, somebody already wrote a book. So I started to look into reading books about sports psychology, and I came across this book called The Inner Athlete. And that was the book that really closed the door for me emotionally as an athlete, because all those 7 years, I wasn't trying to compete. I was trying to win. I wanted to just win. And the book teaches you how to compete. It teaches you how to deal with competition.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the amount of tournaments I won from 97 on, it was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that 97, I might've won 5 tournaments. 98, it might've been 12. 99 was the best year that I ever had.
Yeah.
The Olympic Committee gave me a Saturn. They gave me a brand new car.
Wow.
And it was based on my performance in 1999. We're going to take all the Olympic hopefuls, and whoever has the best year, we're going to give them a vehicle. And I think I went from number 30 in the country to like number 4.
Wow.
So the book is called The Inner Athlete by Dan Millman. Whoever's listening, get that book. Your rating will go up 150 points.
Sounds good. Yeah. Maybe this all boiled down a little bit. From what you said about winning and competing, would you say that's kind of difference between having that set goal of I need to win this thing, and then instead of focusing on that, the end, you're kind of focusing on your journey, and I guess being in the moment, and as you said, competing.
Point
to point.
Yeah, I mean, winning, saying I want to cross the finish line. And competing is saying I want to put one foot over the next foot.
Mm-hmm.
That's complete. Those are completely different concepts that has you in different places and will take you to different places. Because, you know, like where you're at right now, if you're competing, almost doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to win, the only thing that matters is the finish line.
Right.
And you may not be there yet.
Yeah.
So where you at right now does not matter. It's where you're trying to go. It's not where you're trying to end up.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized you win a tournament. Okay, hoo-ha. Get over yourself. You won a tournament. But How do you say, what can I take from this experience that's going to make me a better athlete? It's really understanding when to compete. Man, I think this guy's pushing hard right now. I think he's pressing the issue right now. I need to acknowledge that. I need to actually be in tune with this guy giving me more resistance right now, because now I'm competing. Mm-hmm. You know, so it really is a completely different mindset. And once I learned that, like all of those people that I started to admire and I kind of revered, I said, okay, now I know how to win. Mm-hmm. Now I know how to beat that person, because I'm going to do one footstep over the next, you know. And that was being in South Florida was the thing that really taught me how to compete. And my second DVD is called Competition Table Tennis, and it's based on that premise.
Okay.
Like, if you learn how to compete, then you've already learned how to win.
Right. I got to say, I think this is something I kind of maybe picked up by mistake on the way myself. I just, you know, sometimes I catch myself in the middle of a point thinking, oh no, what if I lose this match? Or how great would it be if I win this match? And, you know, those things are just useless thoughts. You know, what's the point? And then I started realizing.
I got a great story about that. We just call that negative chatter.
Uh-huh.
Or ego chatter. I mean, one time I was at a tournament. I got two quick stories. One time I was at a tournament and I was playing one of my best friends. And I said something negative. I think I might have missed two or three easy shots in a row. And I said, well, go ahead, Brian. Just give him the match. Yeah. And you know what I did? I gave him the damn match.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't get it together.
Yeah.
You know why? Because I had planted that seed in my head that I'm not going to play good today.
Mm-hmm.
So just go ahead and give him the match. And I did. And I said, okay, I'm never going to talk negative to myself again. I'm just going to focus on how to compete. And that might have happened early, but I always remembered once I stopped talking negative, nothing negative would happen.
Mm-hmm.
I would lose, but it wouldn't be a negative experience. And the other story is I was playing some kid in a tournament. We were in a mall in Augusta. If you win the tournament, if you win the junior event, they take you down to Sears or JCPenney's, and you come back on the bike. You win a bike. You win a tournament, he walks you down, you ride back on the bike.
Uh-huh.
And I remember I was taunting this kid because we were playing in a mall, and I hit a ball, and I said, that's in Chick-fil-A. Bring me back some nuggets. And I was just talking trash, and I was doing my Mr. T impressions because that movie had just came out. And I made this kid named Sean Hancock. I turned him into Rocky Balboa. He started trying his ass off.
Uh-huh.
And he won the match. And you know what? I didn't feel bad.
Uh-huh.
When he went down there and came back on the bike, I was clapping. And then I realized I'm never going to get under anybody's skin,
uh-huh.
and I'm never going to talk negative.
Yeah.
And if you do that, you will not have a negative experience. Uh-huh. You can't. Because you can walk away saying, I need to be better at this. I need to be better at that. Not, oh, Brian, I should have just shut my mouth,
right.
You know?
I'm totally buying into that, man. And, you know, like I mentioned, I probably, my last tournament was probably my best tournament. And there's like one moment and I'm like, my nerves are kind of getting the best of me. And I just stopped for a moment. I said, okay, I'm just going to have a little plan here, what I'm going to do. And all I'm going to do is follow the plan as best I can, give my effort. And whether I win or lose this point and, you know, ultimately the match, I mean, I'll live with it. I'll be happy with it. Cause I knew I just had a plan. I'll just do that. And that's the best I can do. And I kind of stopped thinking about that end result and just thought about what am I trying to accomplish right now? And it's not even about winning the point, just, you know, being given my best, effort at that moment. So.
Right. You went from wanting to win to wanting to compete.
Right. Yeah.
That is it. It cannot be explained any more simple than that.
I'm totally on board. And, you know, this is something I wish I learned as a kid, because I played pretty competitively when I was a kid. And, you know, I was coached by Marty and I trained with Randy Cohen for a little bit. And I wish I could go back in time and tell myself, you know, these little things that seem so obvious now. But I guess it's hard to do unless you kind of experience it yourself and really try to ingrain it. But I think that's a great message from yourself and sharing that, and especially with the your videos.
Yeah, listen, I've done so much losing that I don't know anybody that could actually tell that story better than me. It's like, listen, I have lost so much that I don't have anything else to lose.
Right.
All I'm going to gain now is experience. And when I was in Augusta, I think I had two or three big tournaments where I could have took down a big player, and I think it would have kind of launched me to the next level. Mm-hmm. And the coach I had at the time, Coach Punk, he said, "You're not ready yet." And then he'd make these like Bill Cosby statements that where you got to go to your room and think about it. He'd say, "A loss is a mother of a win."
Yeah.
And I said, "Listen, man, look, just can we not play right now? Can just right. tell me right. what I need to learn?" He said, "That's what you need to learn." And right. then he never explained it to me ever.
Uh-huh.
Eventually, I got it.
Yeah.
I said, okay, let me write this down. A loss is the mother of a win. And I drew a circle. Like, this is the mother, and this is the child. You know? So what I was able to take from it is that every time you have an experience, it's like you're blowing air into a balloon.
Yeah.
You know, and you just keep having all these experiences. And then before you know it, you give birth to this very small thing. This is the yeah. good. This is the personification of all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you've done all of this stuff and you spent 20 years being good, and you're going to have like a good 8 months the way you're going to rule the planet, Brian, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this losing, you're going to have this gestation period where you're just still gaining information, and then you're going to have a real good experience, and that's it. You never explained it, but it slowly came to me.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, you got to do so much losing to be where I'm at now. I tell everybody, when you're looking at them videos, looking at them DVDs, right. that's me getting my ass kicked for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you how to not have to go through losing that much to get there, you know?
Well, that's also the big lesson to learn there, that, you know, when you have a loss and should walk away instead of being frustrated, you've learned another lesson. And
absolutely.
That's something that to work on. That's how you get better. And, you know, that's you just take that as a gift, actually. I mean, these all sound like corny Hallmark card sayings, but, I mean, what can I say, man? I'm totally buying into it.
Listen, when you've been losing for 7 years and you win a tournament, I was so happy that I won a tournament. Jason, I moved to South Florida. I won a tournament here in Pompano.
Uh-huh.
I moved here 3 months later. That's how important it was for me.
Wow.
I won. Now I'm going to move here. And then I think I won 3 or 4 more tournaments that year. And then you know what I did? I started going back to those other places that I had lost. I had never won a tournament in North Carolina. I went back there and beat some good players. I never won a tournament in Atlanta. I lived in Augusta 2 hours away. I went back there and won. I never won a tournament in Maryland. I went back there and won. So for me, it wasn't about just winning here. It was learning how to compete and then going back there to say, now I'm ready. I wasn't ready before. I'm ready now, you know? See, I'm ready for whatever, anything, no kill. She made me better. I ain't dead yet. You can take the fame and the challenge and the game and the deal. I'm still a go-getter. Take my freedom for the moment, but it ain't over. I take the spirit of a gun, heart of a dope killer. I'm a king. Seen hanging with some cold killers. I ain't never back. So I thought that'd be a good place to stop right there. A great interview with Brian Pace. He was very gracious to spend 2 hours talking to me. Great discussion there. And like I said, I wanted to split it up into 2 parts. So that concludes part 1. Stay tuned next week for part 2. And don't forget to check out his website, DynamicTableTennis.com. We'll go in more in depth about that in part 2. But in the meantime, please check out his website, DynamicTableTennis.com. It's got a series of DVDs covering all aspects of the sport to improve your game. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. I also have a bunch of other stuff in these show notes, including a YouTube video of Timo Boll's debut in the China Super League. Thanks to user Janice770 who put that up. It's got a lot of other YouTube videos that you can check out. I also have a link to tabletennista.com, a great resource for table tennis news, and in particular, Chinese table tennis news, because there's just no translations for that. So, thanks to that website. Also, like I mentioned earlier, a behind the scenes of the Penhold for Shakehand charity event. You get to see how intense these players are on the table, and now you see them hanging out
with each other, joking around. So it's good just to see another side of the players at the table. And I've got another link to Kickstarter.com. If you're not familiar with this website, it's a pretty popular website where you can fundraise money for your project. How it works is you sign up, you make a proposal, what you want to accomplish, you set a quota of how much money you want to raise, and you set a deadline. So if you raise that money within that deadline, you get the money and mission accomplished. Otherwise, if you don't meet your quota within the time you set, you get no money whatsoever. And why I mention this in particular, there is a documentary in the works. It's directed by Ina T. Sun and Sarah Newlands, and they're trying to film a documentary called Top Spin, which will follow Errol Singh and Michael Anders in their quest to participate in the 2012 London Olympics. Now, I think this is a great project, not only just to make a very interesting, entertaining documentary, but of course following the sport. And this will be a great way to share to just the general public the other side of table tennis. Like we've talked before, we seem to fight this image problem that table tennis is not a real sport. Like that's a parlor game or something like that. So what better way to show people the other side, the competitive side, and how table tennis requires, just like any other sport, the dedication, the training, the talent. And so, I hope you'll check out this website, their Kickstarter.com page. I'll put a link to that and support their project. And in Kickstarter.com, there's also, you can set up a pay schedule where, depending on how much you donate, you can get something in return. So, it's a win-win for everybody. Now, I mentioned that also because I tentatively have an interview lined up with them. So, like I said at the beginning of the show, I'd like to get your input. If there's anything you'd like to ask them, I'll read your email during our interview on the episode, and we'll hear what they have to say. So please email me your questions, check out their website, get what it's all about. Email me your questions, anything you're curious about, and I'll try to get those in the episode and read them to them. And read your name as well. So you can send that to thepongcast@gmail.com. That's thepongcast at gmail.com. I also have another interview tentatively lined up with Mr. Sean O'Neill, who, I hope I'm not overstating it, but I probably will go down as one of our modern U.S. table tennis legends. Sean O'Neill, quite an accomplished player, coaching right now. So please email me your questions if anything you'd like to ask Sean, and I'll try to work that into our interview as well. Finally, you can also email me your feedback in general on the show, any comments, questions, show ideas. People like to hear me interview, and email me again at thepongcast@gmail.com. You can also follow the show on Twitter at thepongcast. There is a Facebook page for the Pongcast. And, you know, if you you can check all that stuff out on the website, got a link to the Twitter feed and the Facebook page, just in case. Also, if you happen to get this through iTunes, please leave a review. I'd appreciate that. And finally, tell your friends, tell your clubmates, and I'll see you next time.